Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Statute of Limitations and Scienter Post-Argument Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 30th, 2009, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Merck v. Reynolds. The issue in this case is whether in a securities fraud case based on alleged material misstatements, an investor plaintiff must have evidence of scienter or something short of that before the statute of limitations starts to run. To discuss the case, we have Deckert LLP partner Stephen A. Engel. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Engel.
This is Stephen Engel, a partner at Deckert LLP in Washington, D.C. I'm going to discuss Merck v. Reynolds, a case that was heard by the Supreme Court on November 30th, 2009. In connection with this case, we represented the Washington Legal Foundation, which filed an amicus brief in support of Merck. In the Merck case, the Supreme Court is considering how to interpret the two-year statute of limitations that governs federal securities fraud claims brought by private plaintiffs under Rule 10b-5. Under the statute, a securities fraud suit must be brought within 2 years from the, quote, discovery of the facts constituting the violation, end quote. The statute thus has what's called the discovery rule, because it runs from the plaintiff's discovery of the violation. The discovery rule has traditionally been applied to all kinds of fraud claims under both federal and state law, and so it's no surprise that it governs federal securities fraud actions under Rule 10b-5. The question presented in this case is when should the plaintiffs be deemed to have discovered the facts constituting such a violation? That question, in turn, requires the court to make two separate determinations. First, the court must determine what are the relevant facts constituting the violation. Second, when, as a matter of law, should a plaintiff be deemed to have discovered those facts? The courts of appeals have disagreed on the answers to these questions in securities fraud cases, and the Supreme Court granted certiorari in the hope of resolving this conflict among the circuits. Although statute of limitations questions may appear really by definition to present technical or nitty legal issues, the truth is that the limitations period frequently plays an important role given the nature of large-scale securities class actions. The elements of a securities fraud action require not simply a fraudulent statement, but also that the market's discovery of the fraud leads to a measurable drop in share value. As a practical matter, plaintiffs' counsel tend to work backwards, observing first the stock prices drop in value, and then investigating to see whether that drop was related to the market's discovery that something the company said in the past was not correct. Because the plaintiff's suit necessarily begins from the time of the stock drop and the alleged false statements were made in the past, we frequently see litigation at the start of a securities action concerning precisely whether the plaintiffs who waited for that big stock drop had acted diligently in bringing their suit or whether their suit should be barred by the statute of limitations. Indeed, the Merck case itself arose out of precisely such a set of circumstances. The plaintiff's claim that Merck had misled the markets by publicly describing the results of certain medical studies as consistent with the safety of Merck's product, Vioxx. Merck's public statements in defense of the studies, however, did not go unchallenged. To the contrary, there was considerable public debate, and most notably in September of 2001, the FDA issued a warning letter expressing its belief that Merck's interpretation of those studies was in fact misleading, and that Merck should make a corrective statement on its label for Vioxx to dispel such misimpressions. Notwithstanding the public debate concerning Vioxx's safety in 2001, the securities fraud plaintiffs in this case did not bring their suit until more than 2 years later, in November of 2003, after Merck had reported disappointing earnings and its stock had experienced a sharp drop. The plaintiffs alleged that this stock drop was due to the revelation of Merck's false statements about the Vioxx studies. Merck, however, points to the FDA's critical letter and the public debate on the subject as evidence that plaintiffs should have been aware of these facts for more than 2 years before they filed suit, and therefore the suit should be barred by the statute of limitations. The principal question before the Supreme Court thus concerned whether this past debate over Vioxx's safety provided the facts constituting the violation, the disclosure of which triggered the running of the statute of limitations. Under the standards applied by the majority of the circuits, plaintiff's suit likely would have been time-barred because those courts had held that the statute begins to run when the plaintiffs have some reason to believe that the defendants had committed a fraud, which could include evidence, for example, that the plaintiffs had made a false statement under circumstances at least suggesting the possibility of bad faith. The Third Circuit, however, held in the Merck case that such facts were not enough. Plaintiffs needed to have not simply evidence that the company's past statements were false, but rather specific evidence that the statements were knowingly false, that is, that the plaintiff made the statement with scienter, the legal term for an intent to defraud. While the FDA letter may have suggested to the plaintiffs that Merck was wrong about Vioxx's safety, in the Third Circuit's view, the plaintiffs did not learn that Merck allegedly did not believe what it was saying until much later. In addition to determining what are the facts constituting the violation, the Merck decision also provides the Supreme Court with the opportunity to resolve a disagreement on when exactly the plaintiff should be deemed to have discovered the relevant facts. The lower courts have generally agreed that a plaintiff should be on notice of a potential suit not simply from the time when the plaintiff actually discovered the relevant facts, but from when a reasonable plaintiff would have discovered them, from the point known as constructive discovery. In other words, a plaintiff cannot stick his head in the ground like an ostrich and avoid reading the newspapers and then later claim he didn't know certain facts which were publicly disclosed on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. In determining the point of constructive notice, courts have held that a plaintiff further must act diligently in responding to indications of a potential fraud. Where the plaintiff is aware of what some courts have described colorfully as storm warnings of the fraud, and the FDA in the Merck case would certainly appear to qualify as such a suggestion, courts have held that the plaintiff then have an affirmative obligation to go forward and investigate their suspicions. This principle is known as inquiry notice, and it is a doctrine with long-standing roots in the common law. Because the discovery rule itself is a common law concept and emerged as an equitable exception to the traditional statute of limitations, which run from the time of the actual violation, not from the time of the plaintiff's discovery of the violation, courts expected that these plaintiffs seeking this equitable relief would themselves act diligently when they encountered the storm warnings of a potential fraud. Under this doctrine, the plaintiff then, upon hearing of such storm warnings, must move forward over the two-year period to investigate and explore the potential for filing suits. Some lower courts, embracing the traditional common law rule, have held that the limitations period begins to run from that point of inquiry notice. Others have found that if the plaintiff does diligently investigate his claims, he may get the benefit of additional time, basically the point at which he completed his investigation and uncovered sufficient information to sustain his suspicions and then file the suit. Consistent with the decisions of the lower courts, both Merck's and the plaintiffs generally agree that inquiry notice has a role to play in determining the point of discovery in a securities fraud suit. The plaintiffs accepted the general principle, but they argue that they would not be on inquiry notice until they had specific storm warnings, not simply of a false statement, but of actual evidence of scienter. The United States, however, actually entered the case as an amicus curiae and took a more aggressive view of the limitation than the plaintiffs. The Solicitor General argued that inquiry notice did not have much, if any, of a role to play in determining when the statute of limitations begins to run. Rather than measuring the storm warnings of a potential fraud, the Obama administration has taken the position that the limitations period begins only when the reasonably diligent plaintiff would possess only when the reasonably diligent plaintiff would possess all the facts necessary to plead a securities fraud claim that would survive a motion to dismiss. In other words, although Congress gave plaintiffs 2 years after the notice of a potential fraud to investigate their claims and prepare their lawsuit for filing, the Solicitor General argued that the 2-year period really serves very little purpose at all because that time only begins to run when the plaintiffs otherwise would have the information at hand that would make them ready to file their suit. The Supreme Court heard oral argument in the Merck case on November 30th. The court heard the case on the first Monday after Thanksgiving, which ensured that the lawyers arguing the case did not get much of a holiday over that weekend. As is not uncommon in high-stakes Supreme Court litigation, the lawyers who argued for the private parties were both veterans of the Solicitor General's office. Canon Shanmugam, now a partner at Williams & Connolly, argued the case for Merck. David Frederick, who's now a partner at Kellogg Huber, argued for the plaintiffs in the securities action. In view of the interests of the United States in the enforcement of the securities laws, Malcolm Stewart, a deputy solicitor general, also appeared as amicus curiae. The Supreme Court has not directly considered the statute of limitations for securities fraud actions since 1991. But in the intervening period, the court has issued a number of decisions making clear that in drafting their complaints, securities fraud plaintiffs must scrupulously comply with all the requirements of the statute, including by meeting the heightened pleading standard for showing scienter, the intent to defraud. These decisions have helped securities fraud defendants, such as Merck, to avoid thinly pleaded securities claims. In the oral argument of the Merck case, however, several justices appeared to believe that these decisions cut in the other direction. As Justice Kennedy said, the companies, quote, can't have it both ways. If the defendants argue that the plaintiffs are required to plead in their complaint particular facts establishing scienter, then you could not expect that information putting plaintiffs on inquiry notice of simply a suspicion of fraud would be enough to start the clock running on the statute of limitations. In response, Merck's counsel emphasized that inquiry notice represented only the first stage of the inquiry, and that where there is mere suspicion, the plaintiff would have the opportunity to conduct a reasonable investigation, and the limitations period may not begin to run until the completion of that investigation. The plaintiffs, had they conducted such an investigation, might have been able to discover additional information that would have proved or disproved their initial suspicions. Since they had not done so, however, Merck argued that the statute of limitations clearly began to run from the point of inquiry notice. Although the lower courts had universally embraced inquiry notice as a general principle, the Supreme Court had a number of questions as to how it should work in practice. What evidence was there that plaintiffs could have actually uncovered any more information about whether Merck had acted with scienter or not? Wasn't such information only in Merck's possession? How are courts going forward to determine whether a plaintiff's investigation was reasonable? And where in the statute was there evidence that Congress, when it referred to the, quote, discovery of the facts constituting the violation, end quote, actually intended to adopt this principle of inquiry notice? The court also asked questions expressing some difficulty with the plaintiff's theory that the limitations period should run only after the plaintiffs had discovered evidence of scienter. The greatest problem for the plaintiff, however, was not strictly speaking a legal one, but a factual question. Between the FDA's issuance of its critical letter in September 2001 and the plaintiff's filing of their lawsuit in November 2003, they could not actually point to any specific evidence of scienter that supported their claims. Rather, the plaintiff's best evidence of scienter was a series of internal emails at Merck that were not released until almost a year later, after November 2004. Plaintiff's principal response to this argument was that since they originally brought the case, they had amended their complaint to include the internal Merck emails, and therefore the court did not have to decide whether their initial complaint was sufficient. Although plaintiff's fortuitous amendment of their complaint may be a sufficient answer to the question for the Merck case, the fact that the plaintiffs basically admitted that they had filed their suit before, even under their theory, the statute of limitations would have even begun to run, strongly suggests that if the court adopts the plaintiff's narrow interpretation of the statute, the two-year limitations rule could be a nullity in the vast majority of securities fraud cases. Rather than forcing plaintiffs to move forward diligently with their claims, as Congress appeared to intend by adopting the discovery rule, the plaintiffs could adopt a wait-and-see approach to measure whether and when the company's stock dropped, without fear that a court would later hold that the statute of limitations had begun to run. If that is the case, the Merck decision then could shift the balance back towards the plaintiffs and lead to a potential increase in the number of securities fraud class actions that could be filed in the future. As it typically does, the Supreme Court reserved decision after the oral argument, and a decision will likely follow this spring. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.